Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Quintessential Listening Poetry. I'm here tonight with a very, very, very special guest, the one and only Mr. Catfish McDarris. Catfish McDarris, his best readings were in Paris at the Shakespeare and Company bookstore and with Jimmy, the Ghost of Hendrick Spencer in New York on 42nd Street. He's done over 20 chapbooks in the last 25 years. He's been in the New York Quarterly, Slipstream, Pearl, Main Street Rag, Cafe Review, Chiron Review, Zen Tattoo, Wormwood, Chiron Review, Zen Tattoo, Wormwood Review, Great Weather for Media, Silver, Birch Press, Mass Tequila Review, and Graffiti, and has been nominated for over 15 Pushcarter Prizes. Best of the Net in 2010 and 2013. He won the Uprising Award in 1999 and won the Flash Fiction Contest judged by the U.S. Poet Laureate in 2009. Also in the Louisiana Review, George Mason University Press, the New Quant from Rhodes University in South Africa. As you can tell, I'm quite excited. He recently has been translated into Spanish, Italian, French, Polish, Swedish, Arabic, Mandarin, Bengali, Yoruba, Tagalog, and Esperanto. His 25 years of published material is in the Special Archives Collection at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he recently published Dancing with Frida Kahlo, and he edited Resurrection of a Sunflower. Catfish McDaniels, McDarris, you're on there. As you can tell, Catfish, I'm very excited about you being here tonight. You're one of my favorite people.
Hey, Michael.
Hello.
I'm ready.
All right. You ready? All right. Then you're on.
Okay. First poem's called Spackling Compound. Hands too damn shaky to be a pickpocket or a poet. Eating crooked duck in Chinatown, studying the abattoir, a.k.a. bank robbery. An alligator smiles from the piano it played, both of their teeth gleaming white. A clown flies through the clouds, shot from a catapult. She had a hole in her heart. He was a spackling compound, thinking each person can find their paradise, the location, an age, a person, their jail of love, and be lucky to never lose it. Gila monsters and snowmen cook beans and go fishing with no hole in the ice, casting hooks in the air, catching blue sparrows, Canadian geese, pigeons, and flying squirrels.
Wow.
That's numero uno.
Numero uno.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Were you destined to be a poet? Tell me why.
I don't know. Everybody's kind of falls into wherever they fall in, you know. I was destined to be a storyteller. And I guess it was storytellers from, you know, from the caveman, you know, writing their stories on the walls, you know, marking fire and running from buffalo and dinosaurs and all that, you know. And those were poems to me, too. And then growing up, the only thing I liked about music better than poetry is you could dance with a lady. and you could bring her in close, you know, and you could feel that touch and have that woman, you know. And then you got, if you got lucky, you know, you had your own poem.
Right, very much so. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Well, favor us again with another piece of poetry.
Okay, this one's called Mescaline Fireflies. This is about Frida Kahlo. Vanilla mescal in the indigo sky. Fireflies make love and war a pie. Frida cut off her long ebony hair and threw the tendrils to the wind. Diego wept blood, seeing his lady in a man's suit, a monkey on her shoulder. The hair took root and grew as peyote cacti, orange and lime trees, figs and grapes. The wind stole the hair and spread it all over the world with Mexican wisdom paint. She became a wounded deer, punctured by arrows at Casa Azul, her heaven, where she will never die. That's from Dancing with Frida Kahlo.
Tell me about your interest in Frida Kahlo.
Okay, well, Frida Kahlo, you know, she was, well, my wife, you know, she lived in Mexico City till she was 13, and she was the youngest of eight, and so we went there to visit a lot of times, and we went to Casa Azul probably. That's the house that she lived in with Diego Rivera. And
yes.
He was a famous muralist and stuff. So I got interested in her back then, but then I started finding out more and more about her, that she was like, she died in 54 and I was born in 53. And so she became the first lady collected in the Louvre from Mexico. And she was, I don't know, she was just injured, and she was totally at mercy from a terrible accident she was in. And I'll explain it in the next poem, which is also true. But the thing is, Frida Kahlo, man, she's right there behind Van Gogh to me. I mean, as far as painters, and she's becoming so popular with the Me Too crowd, and everybody else is learning about her now. You know, and her house is so fantastic down in Mexico City, man. They have buses that go there and tourists and stuff there. But she had an affair with Trotsky. Edward G. Burroughs came. Not Edward G. Burroughs. Edward G. Robinson, I was going to say.
Edward G. Robinson?
Yeah, Edward G. Robinson, the gangster. Yeah, the
yes.
gangster movie star. He bought four of her paintings, you know. And she sold a lot of art, you know. But, you know, she was just fantastic, you know, painter. Okay, if you want to hear this one's called Frida's Gold. And it's true, and it's about Frida's accident. The color of rage, anger, love, hemorrhaging of the sun on the ox-gore face, velvet cocoon eyebrows ready to fly away. You can live your life in a birdcage or soar over oceans, mountains, jungle, swamp, and deserts. The bus and trolley accident broke Frida's spinal column, collarbones, ribs, and pelvis, fractured her right leg in 11 places, and dislocated her shoulder. Frida had polio, and one leg was shorter and the bone thinner than the other. She underwent 35 operations because of the accident. Arias, her boyfriend, was with her in the crash. He described the bus as bursting into thousands of pieces, with a metal handrail ripping through Kahlo's torso. Many were injured. Two died. Something strange had happened. Frida was totally nude. The collision had unfastened her clothes. Someone in the bus, probably a house painter, had been carrying a packet of powdered gold. This package broke, and the gold fell all over the bleeding body of Frida. When the people saw her, they cried, la ballerina, with the gold on her red, bloody body. They thought she was a dancer. Kahlo's path to painting began with the collision. The greedy are selfish fools choking on the gluttony for gold. And that's a true story of the accident of Frida. I recommend everybody that wants to know a little bit about Frida to watch the movie about Frida Kahlo that that was made
Selma
a few
Hayek.
Years ago. Yeah, with Selma Hayek.
Yes.
Yeah. She even had to go, that Hollywood guy that molested all the women, you know, that got in all that trouble. She had to go, you know, kiss up to that guy to get her movie made, you know. And that movie, man, it goes right by her, you know, her life. And I was so surprised because I hadn't seen the movie for years and years, but after I did my research and I wrote this little book, I went back and watched the movie, and I said, man, it's like I just followed her life, you know. And it was
well,
cool.
Let me ask this question. Do you have a favorite poem in that particular book?
I don't think so. I think I like all of them. Those are only, it's only like a mini chap. It's only got 13 poems. And the thing of it is, I did it with a guy on the East Coast, and what I did was to make it different, I only did an A through Z. I only did 26 copies, and they sold out in 10 hours. And I used two milagros. That's miracle in Spanish. But in the churches outside of, in Mexico, they have people that sell milagros, and you take it in their leg, and they'll be like a little leg or a little arm or, you know, whatever parts of the body. And you take them in the church and you pray over them. So I had my friend Chaz that printed it for me, and I forgot which press. I can't think of the press right now. But anyway, he put two of the milagros and tied them onto each chapbook, and I put like a little feather in there, because that's the name of one of the. One of the titles of the poem was Purple Feather, I think. And it was, it was kind of, I tried to put, like, if I had some paper pesos, I tried to put them in there. But, yeah, I sold out those 26 copies in, like, you know, 10 hours. They were gone, you know. And I kind of wish I had more.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, let me ask this question. What sparked your initial love of poetry?
My initial love of poetry, well, to me, it's still about stories. I like poets because of the fact Milwaukee's got a really good scene, and I've kind of been out of it for a while, you know, but people getting up there and reading their poets, and it's kind of like a competition, but people, now I see people, you know, reading off phones and, you know, reading. I used to see people, you know, holding their paper, and then you had the people that had their poems memorized. But other guys, they'd say, "Oh, I haven't memorized my poem. I know it by heart." And that's what Dylan Thomas had. See, the thing was, he said, "I haven't memorized any poems. I just know them all by heart." And I think he only wrote about 100 poems, you know, but he knew every one of them, you know. He could recite, you know. And I think reciting and, well, here now it's like slamming, like the Wu-Tang Clan. Some of that stuff is like poetry, but they get too wild and, you know, and they're cutting down on each other and,
right.
They bring racism into it, you know, even though, I don't know, it just gets to me sometimes. But I love poetry. And one of the best places to go to see a good slam or a good poetry reading is the Green Mill in Chicago. And that's mm-hmm. where they invented the slam. And that was years ago. And that mm-hmm. was Al Capone's, one of Al Capone's hangouts, you know. Back a long time ago, but real classy bar, you know, and they have a lot of places. But New York City's got some, but I still say the Green Mill's got it over any in New York, you know.
All right. Well, thank you. We have a caller, actually, and I'm going to bring this person in. Area code 816. First, the numbers are 560. You're on the air. Hello? Well, maybe they're shy.
Hello?
Maybe they're shy. Yes.
Was that my
number?
Do
you have a question for Kathy? Excuse me?
No, I just, I'm just listening on my phone.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Really?
Thank you for listening.
It's going to.
Oh, it's G-Man. You gotta meet this guy. The name is Will Wells.
It's me.
Welcome, G-Man.
I am transfixed, man. This is the readings are so good, and the poems and the commentary and everything, man. This is wonderful. Don't let me interrupt.
One day. All right. Well, thank you for calling. Keep listening.
I am.
All right. Let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back. Good evening. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram, and welcome to Quintessential Listening Poetry. I'm here with a very special guest, Mr. Catfish McDarris. Catfish, continue this journey with another piece of your work.
Okay, now I'm going to switch gears here. I'm going to read a Pushcart-nominated piece of flash fiction. It's almost like prose poetry, though. It's about my daughter and me when she was 4 years old. She's 30 now. It's called Hippopotamus Summer. She lived 4 summers and loved Snake Alley noodles, Delaware punch, strawberry ice cream, and the wildflowers that grew along the railroad tracks, which divided the old celery fields of West Milwaukee. Different kinds of flowers grew each summer: purple coneflowers, oxeye sunflowers, blue lobelia, Jacob's ladder, and black-eyed Susan. Their seeds mostly planted by birds and animals. The last summer, wild, crazy, red, yellow, and orange sunflowers conquered the hippopotamus-colored steel tracks. The green stalks and roots wore snake down through the black goo creosote-coated railroad ties. The tracks took me back 40 years to an all-night walk across the vast Fort Worth, Texas, to catch a westbound freight for home in New Mexico. Stumbling over ankle-spraining rocks and gravel and jumping into the prickly pear and yucca to avoid getting creamed by an Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Express, my young daughter wanted to get a few flowers for her room. We stopped at the store for a few items, and I pulled back to the loading dock area where the jungle of flowers were. Okay. I thought this is a 30-second job, and I opened my pocket knife and I asked her to remain in the cool car. I got out and was almost done when I felt the tug of a small hand on my shirt. There was my daughter with a big smile that pulled and stretched my heart halfway to Tucumcari. The car was running with the keys locked inside. I noticed a semi-truck with another behind it waiting to use the dock. I grabbed my daughter's little hand and told the truck drivers I'd need to call my lady for an extra set of keys. They were not happy. 15 minutes later, Mom came to the rescue and we got out of the predicament. That was 20 years ago. I've seen Van Gogh's sunflowers in Arles, but none compare to the beautiful memory of my ladies and the hippopotamus summer.
Beautiful. In what important ways does poetry differ from fiction or flash fiction? How does poetry differ?
To me, if you're writing prose, prose poetry, that is flash fiction. I mean, to me, they're the same thing. I had a guy tell me, an English teacher, years and years ago. His name was Theron Moore. He was kind of a Bukowski pal. He told me, he said, "Catfish, you got a good, you're a good writer, but you're writing too much me poetry. You're like, I did this, I did that. You're a talk poet. You write about talking in the bathroom, talking in the bedroom, talking at the bar." He says, "Introduce some third person, you know, find you a character and, you know, let them do the talking, you know, and the walking." And I always kind of like to put my, put myself, you know, away from what I'm writing about, you know. I'll invent characters and stuff, and but as far as being poetry and prose poetry, I think it's just the way somebody writes, you know. I know a few poets that they'll sneak in a rhyme every now and then, and I kind of like that, you know, because you kind of got to be watching for it or you won't even see it, you know. But, yeah, I like that, you know. But some people, they say, "Oh, rhyming poetry? What do you think you are, Dr. Seuss or something?" You know, but me, I like it.
Well, there are different schools of thought in terms of whether a person should rhyme or not, whether that's essay. I can understand that. I can understand
that. Yeah, well,
that.
I don't want to be Hallmark, you know. That's too much stuff, you know, trying to jerk the tears out of your eyes on Mother's Day or anything like that. But,
right.
Yeah.
Well, favor us again.
Okay. Okay, now this one's going to be from Resurrection of a Sunflower. And this one's called Red Vineyards Near Arles. This was the only painting he sold while living in 1880 at age 27. He decided to become an artist. He taught himself to draw and paint, supported by his brother Theo. He painted 2,000 works in 10 years at a furious pace, 900 paintings and 1,100 drawings. He used impasto paint and thick textures of brush, palette knife, and hands. In 1886, he joined Theo in Paris and met Degas, Toulouse-Lautrec, Gauguin, Pizarro, and Gauguin. Gauguin again, huh? Anyway, Gauguin lopped off his ear with a sword and cut curious zigzags above his ear. They lied to the police, saying he did it to keep Gauguin out of prison. In June 1889, he went to St. Remy de Provence Asylum, where from the window facing east just before sunrise, he painted Starry Night. His dying words were, "The sadness will live forever." His art will live forever, too.
Well, let me ask you a question. Tell me about the genesis of that particular book.
Well, I happened to... I had a book. My first book was called Van Gogh's Ear. And it was just a little chap, you know, a little shabby chapbook, you know. I think it was in the 80s. And this guy, his name is Ralph, and you spell it R-A-L-F, Ralph Stolten. He was the librarian for the Van Gogh Library in, I forgot the name of the town, somewhere in the Netherlands. And it's on a street where Van Gogh lived for a couple of years. Anyway, he wanted me to send him a free copy, signed copy and stuff. And I told him, I said, "I don't have any copies." And we started talking, and we talked about Vincent and everything. And I had a good friend. His name is Dr. Mark, too, but it's Dr. Mark Pizikowski. Him, me, and Mendez Biondo, he's an Italian guy. We now have Ramingo's Porch, but that's another story. That's a magazine we're running now. But anyway, me and Mark, we got in with Ralph, and we had him write the intro, and we were gonna call it "Death of a Sunflower," and and Ralph suggested that we call it "Resurrection of a Sunflower." So we got really good. We got a Nobel nominated Chinese author. He'd been nominated, I think, 3 times. And he did some calligraphy and wrote a long poem, and his partner had a Van Gogh portrait. And then I had a really good friend that did a art for the back cover. So then we thought that we'd invite poets from around the world to send in essays, poems, you know, flash fiction, whatever. But we wanted them to get 10 pages, you know, to hopefully try for 10 pages, you know, for the thing. That way we hope that if they had 10 pages in it, they would have enough invested in it that they'd buy a copy, because we plan on going big, which it ended up being 550 pages, you know. And it took us, we had people from all over the world, you know, from the only place where, and we had Amazon distribute it. The only place they wouldn't send it to was Tunisia and Nepal. We had to send that to them, but through the mail. But anyway, yeah, man, we had a big book, and we finally broke even after about a year and a half. You know, we got out of the red, you know, because postage was monstrous on that, you know.
Well, let me ask this question. So I can purchase a copy on Amazon.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, listen, everyone. Please continue.
Yeah, if you just go on Amazon Books and just put my name in there, McDerris, Catfish, yeah, it'll come up. Yeah, Resurrection of a Sunflower. And there's no cussing in there. I mean, it'd be good for a Christmas present or whatever. You know, we kept it, you know, PG, even G-rated mostly. You know, but everybody came in with a different idea about Vincent. You know, from Italy, from Africa, from you know, Germany, from everywhere. You know, all over New Zealand, Australia. And everybody had different connections to Vincent and what they thought about him. And that was one of the interesting parts to me, was getting worldwide opinion on him, you know, because he's such a popular guy.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book. We've got some callers on the line. I'd like to bring them in. All
right.
Yeah.
Hey, man.
Code 256.
Hey, bro, how you doing, Mike?
874. Is this Gary Malone?
This is he. This be me, Wing Dog.
Hey, Wing Dog, what's up, man? I haven't heard from you in a coon's age.
Yeah,
I don't mean
yeah.
a coon. I mean a raccoon. Sorry.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I was trying to navigate through that. I ain't been on Blog Talk in so long. I was trying to get... feel my way around.
Okay. You gonna favor us with one?
Huh?
Are you gonna favor us with one? Read a poem, man.
Oh man, I come in just to call in and say hi to listen to you. I didn't have nothing. Oh man, you cut me off. You want to hear something?
Hell yeah.
Oh. Okay. I haven't done this in a long time, man.
Well, I'm glad you're back.
All right, this piece is called "I Smile," and you'll probably get the gist of it after you listen to it. I smile because I'm happy. Really? After watching the evening news as history repeat itself, besides 32 pearly white teeth, I wonder if others wonder what's really hidden behind these two pressed lips. What exactly they don't see. Crest may remove stains, but not even Colgate can hide prolonged fear and enduring pain. Brought on by years of frustration, trials and tribulation, that somehow overshadowed brief civil periods of jubilation. If justice were Lady Liberty's father, he constantly rapes and commits incest with her offspring, producing illegitimate bastards and all of them named injustice. Very hesitantly and half-heartedly, I smile. Through clenched teeth, I pray through clenched fists as I pound the air angry like Cuban Gooding Jr. at the menaces at society that ominously bearing down like a double-barreled shotgun on our young boys in the hood. And with a hint of sarcasm, I smile and I shake my head at the lopsided grand indictment that handed down on a grand scale that often tips justice's scale, favoring injustice. Crumbling my face, now I frown. Hiding behind a mask of confusion, a cover for this disillusional wishful thinking that justice would be served. And it was cold and very hard to swallow. See, with a fake smile, I smirk as an attempt to move this indignation I feel to a righteous place. But please, please don't confuse this bright beam trying to constrain the riot in my eyes. Flames of fury burning like Jeremiah's fire. These smothering apples of these eyes are hot as fillings in hot apple pie. For the parents of Trayvon, Jordan, Michael Brown, Sean Bell, Tamir Rice, Tony Robinson, Eric Garner, Alton Sherlin, and Fernando Castro. I cry tears of sorrow to hide the hurt and the disappointment and the shame of America's injustices. I weep and I sigh. I dry my eyes at the burning spirit of heaviness and eulogizing our slain leader legacy because it currently appears that there's no heirs to their cause. Where are the new leaders willing to inherit today's challenges? Reluctantly, I smile again as I purge myself from injustice's iniquity, reflecting on the memory of Jane Chackney, Andre Goodman, Michael Swann, and Emmett Till. But I smile knowing one day the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And I will then smile a new smile when I see injustice coffin riding first.
Damn. That's very powerful. Very
oh,
powerful.
Yeah. You still got
very
it, Moondog. I mean, Green Dog. Green Dog. Green Dog, man. Let me get it right.
Dude, I hadn't done that in a long time.
Shit, man.
Wow.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you called in.
Oh.
All right, let's
great.
Take a brief break. Let's take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Catfish McDarris. Hold on.
Thank you.
Quintessential Listening Poetry. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. The call-in number is 646-787-1631. We have another caller on the line, Catfish. I'll bring this person in.
You want me to go or them?
Okay, let's see who this person is. All right. Alexis.
Oh, yeah.
Are you there, Alexis? Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
You have a question for Catfish.
Oh, I was just listening. I didn't know I'd be on the air. I was just listening in. Catfish is a friend of mine.
Okay. Catfish, Alexis is on the air.
Yeah, you want to read it, Alexis?
Wow, put me on the spot. Sure.
Oh, great.
Let's see. This is from my latest book called Junkie Wife, published by Moontide Press. It's called Snapshots and Lies. One. Our bodies are a haven from August. This summer, all we do is rut. Mattress on the carpet, him on me, a miasma of scorching discontent. Two, dingy sheets. The dryer eats them, and my future gets stuck in the holes. Three, how did I know he wanted that baby? Four, at the window, he smokes Marlboros, taps ashes on the losers below. Five, there's not enough air to go around. Six, I found a corpse in the kitchen, I tell him. Seven, he flicks his dead daddy's Zippo again and again, surveys the neon-tinged city. Eight, I want to steal something important. Nine, I reach for his pride on the window ledge. He flicks me away like a gnat. 10. The TV's been broken since May. That's it.
That's it. Sounds good.
Beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
What was your inspiration?
Shooting dope and being powerless, remembering what that was like, bad marriage, bad everything. You know, you put yourself back there and see what comes out, right?
Yes, I can understand that. I can understand that.
I know you can.
Yes. All right. Catfish, you're back on, my friend. Thank you, Alexis.
Right.
You're welcome.
Right. Thank you, Alexis. Here's one, it's called Vincent Circle. Years heaped like golden maple leaves in Quebec, or snowflakes on a Tucumcari coyote moon night on Route 66. Sometimes the heart is nothing more than a clock measuring your minutes, ticking and pumping in your chest. Life, death, earth, moon, sun, all moving in circles. Wise nomads live in circles. Right angles make you a square and a box. You live like a cattle, not free buffalo. If you run a race against death, it always gets a head start, unless you're on the train to everywhere, or you can ride a elephant through the eye of a needle.
Well, let me ask this question. Many poets have different methods for their writing. Some write on paper. Others type their work out and then transfer it. What is your favorite writing method?
Well, since I was a postal clerk for 34 years, probably like Bukowski was for 14 years, I just keep a piece of paper and a pen in my pocket. And if I see a line or in my head or going through, you know, somewhere or something, or some remind me of something, I write it down. And then later I might write it in longhand at home, or I'll just get it into a new file, you know, and later I'll see where it fits like a jigsaw puzzle. I'm currently working on three novels, so I always need lines and ideas and stuff like that. And I also always have poems going on and short stories and stuff like that. Sometimes I try to keep one or two pieces of paper. And my wife, since we've been married 35 years, she's used to me stopping somewhere in the middle of somewhere and just start writing frantically, you know. Like one time we were in the grocery store, and I had a piece of paper, and I was writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. And then I ran out of paper, so I grabbed the carton of Kool-Aid, you know, with all the little packets, and I emptied them out, and I started writing on it, man. She walked away. She was like, man, I don't know this guy, you know. And I wrote on it, and pretty soon the store manager came. He says, can I help you? Can I help you? And I'm like, nah, just give me a few minutes, man. I got to keep writing, you know, and I keep writing. Anyway, my wife says, oh, man, what did you do this time, you know? But you never know when something good's going to hit you. And sometimes the worst is when you go to bed and just as you're going to sleep, the line hits you, the one you've been looking for. And the line hits you, but you're too lazy to get up and write it down, man. Or you don't want to wake up your partner, you know. So sometimes I'll sneak in the closet and write it down because I'm afraid by morning, you know, it'll be gone, you know. And
let me ask this existential question. Why is poetry important?
Why is it? Well,
yes.
I think it's important. It's just, you know, a form of communication. But the thing is, poet is important more to poets than it is to the normal people. I mean, we write, and some people aren't going to understand what the hell we're writing about. Like, you're an academic. You got your PhD. You know, me and Alexis and I, we don't have a degree. She might have one, but I don't. And it's all different people, you know, from all different races, from all different sexual, things. Everybody can get along together, you know. I have a lot of gay friends, but I'm not gay. But, you know, and they accept me more than you know, straight people. I have a lot of black friends, and they'll accept me more than white people, you know, and Mexican people and stuff like that, you know. So to me, is there's no color boundary or race or anything like that. And it's just like poets love other poets. But if you get a room full of poets and you got to go up there and do your reading, they're going to try to outdo each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things. I know Wing Dog would kill me. I know he could, man. He's good.
Wing Dog is an incredible poet. And I hope to have him on as a guest.
Wing Dog is natural, man. He's a natural fact, man. I'd like to go to New York with him, man. We'd have a blast.
Well, we have another caller. Hold on one second. Area code 301. The first three numbers are 710. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Catfish. It's great to hear you, and I'm glad you muted it because I was cracking up. You were reading.
Welcome, Marianne. Welcome, Marianne. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Marianne.
Great to hear you, Catfish.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Do you have a question for Catfish?
You going to read one tonight?
I could read something from the sun, you know, resurrection from the sun, resurrection of a sunflower. I'm kind of fried because I had my crazy day. I realized that I have a class of rambunctious boys. One of them is about 40.
Yeah.
He's the most rambunctious.
Yeah. Well, I'm 65. I'm rambunctious, too.
Well, I'm 55.
I'm glad you're
I'm
not in that 5 o'clock class.
Yeah, let me get in your class.
All right. Marianne, please share a piece of your work.
Okay. I think I'll read Home from the Oncologist. Parking her car, and this is also from Resurrection of a Sunflower. Parking her car, Thelma counts the crows, balancing on the roof of her house. The birds are almost as big as chimneys. She tries to remember whether crows mean death. No. Maybe owls or ravens are the auguries out west where trees tower over houses. But she knows Van Gogh's last painting, the murder of crows in the cornfield, a day or two before he died. She will ask her friends. She cannot ask her husband. He's been dead 2 years. Thelma watches the crows fly off to the neighbor's large house. Okay. Oh, brother.
Oh. Tell us about the inspiration, Marianne.
Actually, there's a little more.
Oh, okay.
Thelma watches the crows fly off to the neighbor's large house. Crows are just birds up there. On her roof, they loomed like bad omens from night, swirling with coal dust and cigarette smoke, throbbing with nausea. From another painting whose light is just a smear of yellow and orange, oils trapped behind black lines. She pictures her family's ghosts hovering over her street, trying to find where she lives. Once they find her, she must join them. Okay, so what inspired this poem? Well, Catfish was putting together his anthology and said, you know, hey, come join me, you know, write some poems. I said, this is the semester. So, but, you know, nonetheless, I did. And I was, you know, thinking about the last poem that Van Gogh made, The Murder of Crows in the Cornfield. Also, at the time, my cat Thelma was sick. She had hyperthyroidism, so, you know, we were worried about her. She had gotten really, really skinny. And, you know, a friend of mine from high school was dying of cancer, so I think that was bubbling up in there.
All right. I can understand. Mm. I'd like to thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Nice to have you.
Well, Catfish, you're back on, my friend. Favor us with some more poems. More poetry.
More poetry, okay. This one's called The Blue Throat of Day. Coltrane in the Van Gogh rain. My boss was from Texas. She loved me being a writer. I showed her my latest. She said, "You like Train?" I nodded yes. "What are your favorite songs?" she plays. "Lazy Bird" and "The Night Has a Thousand Eyes." "You must have taken a buku acid back in the day." "Who's your sketch of?" I said. "Vincent Willem Van Gogh." "Not bad, kid." We both laughed since I was twice her age. Back to Gauguin, he lopped off Vincent's ear. And Vincent said he did it. That was it. I wanted to read this one here.
Okay.
So I just learned this word. I don't know if you know it. Do you know what a yeggman is? A yeggman? It's a safe cracker.
No, anyway. I didn't know that. No.
I didn't either, man. I just heard it somewhere, and it just stuck in my brain. And it was about this lady. I'm gonna read one that's more, a little bit more borderline. It's from a new book that I did before. It's called The Ass of the Statue of Liberty. And I'm gonna roll it up here a little bit. Okay. Her ass was fire. Her ass was the sun, the moon, a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Her ass laughed and cried. It could make brave men cowards. It could start wars. It could make rich men beggars. It could turn saints into sinners. It could turn water into whiskey. It could make the rain come down. When she walked through the Louvre, it turned the Mona Lisa into the screen. Her ass was biblical, was of biblical proportions. Her ass started playing kazoo, but soon mastered all wind required instruments, including the slide drum, trombone. Her ass made lions and bears roar with hunger. It was the Queen of Sheba doing the twist. Cleopatra in her prime, walking like an Egyptian. Marilyn Monroe in a sheer white dress. All the beauty that Paul Gauguin captured in Tahiti. The marlin that Santiago lost to the Sharks. Babe Ruth's grand slam over center field. Her ass was Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes. Jimi Hendrix's guitar from Woodstock. It was Steve McQueen's motorcycle from The Great Escape. A winning Powerball lottery ticket. The Hope Diamond. It was all the words from Pablo Neruda, Lai Po, Tu Fu, and Sun Tzu's The Art of War. It was a saber-toothed tiger, a killer bee, a Spanish fly, a zillion tarantulas crawling up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Her ass was a great pyramid at Giza, Chichen Itza, the Taj Mahal, Stonehenge. Her ass was the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, naked, doing cheers on the Great Wall of China. As her ass, her fine ass, retreated, I poured gas all over my body and waited for lightning. The end.
Wow. You know, poets usually have other favorite poets that they visit often. Can you suggest poets for people to read that they may enjoy checking out?
Bukowski.
Bukowski?
I mean, yeah, Bukowski, man, shit. You can read Bukowski all day long. I just had a thing that was kind of a funny thing. I got this book from Charles Bukowski. It's called Reach for the Sun, Selected Letters from 78 to 94. And I never knew that. I'd never read it before, but it's letters to Bukowski. You know, he died in 94. And in 91, he had a letter that Dave, this guy named David, it's David, but it didn't have a D-A-V-D. David Reeve wrote him, and he's the guy that gave me the name Catfish. Years and years ago, when I was still Steven, and I was writing under my real name, Steven, with a V, and I told him I wanted to quit the post office and start a catfish farm, and he started calling me Catfish, and that's how I got that name. But I just came up on that letter today to David Reeve, you know, but it didn't have anything about catfish, but still, I thought it was kind of cool. Yeah, I'd say, you know, Bukowski for one. I don't know. I like the Asians, Lai Po and Tu Fu. You know, I don't know. I like Alexis. I like Marianne. You know, those are two that I read with. I used to like Janine Pommy Vega. She's dead now. She was a friend of mine. She wrote a book called Tracking the Serpent. Man, I'd highly recommend that. It's not poetry though, but it's like prose poetry. The whole book, man. She was beatnik, man. She knew Herbert Hunky and all those guys. You know, Ginsberg and Burroughs, all that. I like some of Ginsberg, but I never really cared for Kerouac. I mean, as far as Mexico City Blues, nah. On the Road, it was okay, you know. But there's some poets out there. I like Ryan, a new guy out from Canada, Ryan Flanagan. I can't remember. Anyway, I like a lot of the new ads. I like yours. I like your stuff.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I like Wing Dog. I think
Wing Dog, yes. Wing Dog's incredible. Well, let me ask this question. Favor us again with another piece of your work.
Okay, now this one, I'm going to take a different route here. This is something that, this one's called Slicing Warp Space with Occam's Razor. And I hardly ever do anything science fiction, but I just always had this wonder, did people really go to the moon? I don't think they did, because I think it was all faked. Anyway, here goes a poem. Once upon a time, people walked on the moon. They picked up some rocks. They planted some flags. They drove around in a buggy. Then came back. Conspiracy theory. Did we land on the moon? The United States grew so eager to defeat the Soviets in this intensely competitive 1960s space race, they faked all 11 Apollo missions. It was all a hoax. The evidence is countless. 42 years since the last man ever moonwalked. Air bubbles coming out of spacesuits in space. Let's call it a space giant underwater pool, one located in the U.S., one in Russia. Use of blue screen in NASA broadcast from space. Not a single photo contains a single star. When shot from the moon, Earth scale compared to the moon is wrong. In all photos, the moon as a smaller body should look larger than. Is no real image taken of planet Earth. All are composite images. Astronauts bounce like magic or puppets. An astronaut has his finger exposed in space. That would produce severe frostbite. The landing was recorded from a monitor to fuzzy up the images, to hide the cables and the other mistakes during the staged landing of NASA in a large money laundering scam. Why haven't we been back? If we really went, why haven't we been back? Some days you hoaxers will do better research. And what about when the astronauts called Richard Nixon? I just don't think we went, man. At all.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Go ahead, please. No, please.
Okay.
Oh, I see. I'll ask this question. You've been writing for a period of time, a long period of time. How has your idea of poetry changed since you began writing poems?
Well, when I first started writing, I wrote a Western. A lot of people don't know that about me, and that's one of my novels that I'm working on now. I wrote a Western. I sent it to New York City, and that was about almost 40 years ago. And I loved writing cowboys. I read Cowboys and Indians when I was in the Army, man. You know, I loved it. You know, comic books, stuff like that. But poetry, I didn't really get turned on to poetry until I got in the small press. But when I started reading, you know, people took me to reads here in Milwaukee, and, man, there was all kinds of craziness, you know. I mean, guys would dress up in dresses and wedding dresses, and, you know, and they'd have suitcases full of $2 bills with newspaper in there you know, women dressed, you know, almost ready to pop out of their dresses and stuff, you know, and I don't know. It's just the poetry readings themselves were a gathering of minds, and they were a gathering of crazy people, you know. It was just a fun thing to do, you know. But They still have them here, but not like they used to be. I mean, we had Jeffrey Dahmer stalking, you know, our poetry readings. You know, he bought 3 of my chapbooks. Man, after they arrested him, the cops came to my house, you know, and said, "Who, how do you know Jeffrey Dahmer, you know? And they want to search my freezer and everything. I said, you're going to look in there. I don't have any body parts, you know. But, yeah, man, you know, that's crazy. But the poetry, I kind of like to go to poetry, but it's kind of boring, too, you know. I mean, if the people aren't good readers or they can't hold their attention, then you're probably going to be there only so you can do your reading and get your stuff out there and hope you're better than the next guy. And now they have the push cards. It used to be more fair with the push card prizes. I mean, nobody could nominate you for a push card unless they had won one. So here I am with Gerald Lachlan and people, Antler, and people that had won these awards, and they were nominating me for, you know, for flash fiction, short fiction, or poetry, and that. But now any Joe Blow can start a blog, and he can nominate people for pushcards and stuff, you know. And now I don't know, man. It's losing its validity. You know what I mean? I mean,
yes, I do.
I think you can. I think it would be hard for me. I'm such a hardhead, you know. I would have a hard time taking a poetry class from a poetry professor, you know, because I would be thinking, how are they going to teach me how to write, man, you know?
Right.
Unless
let me ask this question as we close out, and it's that time to close out. You know, usually people want to know, what are you doing next? What's next for you as a poet, as an author? What's next?
Well, like I said, I'm working on these three novels. I'm working on a story called Mastodon Kush. It's part of my novel. It's mostly about marijuana. It's kind of about a little bit about the marijuana becoming legal now. I never thought that would happen, you know. But yeah, that and going to Mexico, man.
Wow.
I better keep writing. But it's going to be on the side, you know. The poetry's
going to
be on the side. And unless maybe in Spanish I'll do it. I know a few poems in Spanish.
Well, I want to thank you. I mean, I could talk to you all evening. I mean, you're a fascinating person. You're a fascinating person, and I want to say thank you again. You made my day by being a guest on my show, and I want to say, again, just thank you very, very much. And
okay,
I hope we have
thanks to all the people that
again.
Called in, and thanks for having me, Michael. And adios, amigo.
Adios, amigo. All right, everyone, have a good evening.
Bye.
This is Quintessential Listening Poetry, and we're off the air. Thank you.